We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. I'm David Wright, and you're listening to Focus 580. Our guest this morning is John T. Edge. John T. is a director of the Southern Foodways Alliance of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi. He's a columnist for the New York Times and also a contributing editor for Gourmet and the Oxford American. He's been nominated for 4 James Beard's Foundation Awards, including the MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. He's also a regular contributor to TV and radio. And this morning, we're going to talk about food, Southern culture, and any number of things. So join me in welcoming John T. Edge, and I welcome you all to call. People in Champaign-Urbana can call at 333-9455, and people not in Champaign-Urbana can call the toll-free number at 800-222-9455. So welcome, John.
Thanks, David. Glad to be here.
Well, I wanted to start off by talking a little bit about your writing. It seems like in what you write, you're drawn to a certain irreverence, whether it's, you know, Eugene Walter or a restaurant in the Mississippi Delta where you dine behind a curtain so anything is permitted. So I'm curious, what is it about Southern foodways that you find irreverent?
I take what I do very seriously. I think that food is a way to explore serious-minded issues, race and class and all that stuff. But then there's a part of me that also realizes it's just dinner. I don't ever want to forget that piece of it, that it's just dinner. And I think, you know, the very first piece I ever wrote, very first magazine piece I ever wrote, I worked a Lucky Dog cart in New Orleans, those hot dog shaped carts that are on every corner in New Orleans. And I was inspired to do that by Confederacy of Dunces, the John Kennedy Toole novel, which is, I think, one of the greatest pieces of American literature of the latter half of the 20th century. I love that novel, and I love the absurdity of that novel. And I think that, you know, to work a hot dog cart, to peddle weenies for 4 days, which is what I did, is an absurd act. And, you know, to eat a hot dog in New Orleans is an absurd act. Those are scary things. I want to take seriously what I do, but I also want to explore the ridiculousness of food culture in America.
And did you make a lot of hot dog sales?
I did. The last night I worked was New Year's Eve. We pulled in about $3,000 that night. And one of the scariest moments in my life was helping this woman, Big Alice, push the cart out of the quarter through the Central Business District into the shed where the carts were kept with $3,000 on my person and Alice asking me to be on the watch out for somebody that was going to roll us. I sold a lot of weenies.
You seem to have a special and a longstanding connection to New Orleans. How have you noticed that food culture has changed since Katrina?
Before Katrina, food was easy in New Orleans. Food was mundane. Food was every day. Po' boy shops were on the corner because po' boy shops had always been on the corner. Fried chicken joints like Willie Mae's Scotch House and the Treme, or a gumbo restaurant like Dookie Chase and Treme, was a fact of life. When the levees failed and the waters rose and restaurants like that were knocked out, and in many cases knocked out for 2 and 3 years, food was no longer every day. Everyday food was special. And in many ways it remains so. Although po' boy shops have returned, although Willie Mae's Scotch House has returned, although Dookie Chase has returned, there's this sense of fragility about those places. And in some ways, you know, that's not all bad. I mean, there's this realization that these are cultural institutions that matter deeply. And I think that New Orleans residents now realize that. And I think that tourists who go to New Orleans, I mean, you know, I think for so many people, New Orleans, you know, we all seek a kind of situational citizenship in New Orleans. We all want to know the city, and to know the city is, you know, to know Paris is to know a lot. In this country, to know New Orleans is to know a lot. And I think for tourists and for locals, this knowledge now extends to the fragility of that cultural fabric, the fragility of those restaurants. That's what's changed.
Have a lot of restaurants disappeared then, or?
Few have disappeared. Okay. I think at the point now there are more restaurants in New Orleans now than there were before Katrina. So the recovery in New Orleans, it's certainly not complete, but in terms of access to great food, we're back where we were. What's changed, though, is the purposefulness of that rebuilding. You know, one of the things I love about New Orleans is, you can see how a neighborhood developed and how a particular block developed. And, you know, there's a vernacular development to that. There is, it's not purposeful. And now you see a purposefulness, a construction of culinary culture in a way that you didn't see before. Before, culinary culture evolved, and now you have people rebuilding, and they're rebuilding po' boy shops as opposed to a store on the corner that started selling po' boys because, you know, they were selling roast beef and ham in the refrigerator case and had some bread that came in from Leidenheimer's, and all of a sudden they were a po' boy shop. There's a purposefulness to the cuisine now that you didn't see before.
And is it centralized in the way that it was around, or seemed to me at least, around the French Quarter, or has it moved some? Has it shifted?
The Quarter is a tourist mecca, and on the back end of the Quarter, the lower river portion of the Quarter, as you head towards Faubourg Marigny and the Bywater, and eventually the Upper Ninth Ward and the Lower Ninth Ward. That part of New Orleans has always been residential. That part of New Orleans has always been local. But now you see the kind of tourist traffic and the visitor traffic and the local traffic centered not in the Quarter. You see it centered uptown along Magazine Street. And that's where a lot of the newer restaurants are opening. It's not as if the Quarter is drawing people anymore. So now, it still draws people, but I think the real new life is uptown along the spine of Magazine, which, like the Quarter, was relatively high ground and wasn't hard hit in the wake of the levee failures.
In much of your writing, you don't avoid the subject of race, which is one of the things that I really admire about what you do. In your essay, you wrote about Jones Barbecue Diner in the Delta, you liken white patronage to this traditionally black establishment as the culinary equivalent of a booty call. You call it an ephemeral indulgence, entered into lightly and exited from easily, which I thought was really just a really wonderful way to capture it, but it also gets at a really difficult point about Southern culture, certainly the history of Southern culture. You also, in that same essay, and I'm just going to read from the essay, you write, to eat in a proper barbecue joint is to engage in time travel, in a time travel exercise, wherein cookery is reduced to its most elemental, and the past, both good and ill, emerges from the smoky depths each day, which, again, another really wonderful observation. So I just wondered if you would speak a little bit more to that issue of race relations and how it plays itself out historically, and maybe even, and also even today, in Southern foodways.
Well, you know, I'm a white son of the South, and I feel like through my writing, I'm in some ways trying to kind of pay down a debt of pleasure that has accrued over generations. I grew up in a small town in Georgia. I grew up about a quarter mile from a barbecue joint, and I realized that I could tell you, when I started writing and started writing about food, I realized that I could tell you the name of the woman that owned the barbecue joint. Her name was Miss Coulter. I could tell you, any number of things about her family. I can picture her right now. She had this kind of tight henna swirl of curls. She had granny glasses. She wielded a cleaver. and she looked a little frightening. But I can't tell you who cooked that barbecue because I never knew. And I, and now going back, you know, I begin to piece together who cooked that barbecue. And in the South, for the longest time, the men and women who cooked in white-owned establishments, in white homes, were black. But what, you know, what I saw, what the South saw was a black hand extending, you know, a black hand on a skillet, a black hand on a pit shovel, but not a black face, not, you know, a black name to tie to that. And, you know, that sounds like a fairly typical guilty liberal Southerner's perspective. And, yeah, sure.
Well, and let me remind everybody, you're listening to Focus 580, and our guest today is John T. Edge, Southern food writer, Southern culture writer. In what way do you see that still playing itself out today?
You see it in a restaurant like Willie Mae's Scotch House. We talked about New Orleans. Mm-hmm. You know, here, you know, this restaurant owned until recently by Willie Mae Seton, who just turned 93. Mm. And when you talk about New Orleans food with New Orleans food freaks, and you list the great restaurants in New Orleans, her name didn't come up until she lost her restaurant. She was not known. She was a part of this generation of cooks in New Orleans. Austin Leslie was another example of that. Mr. Leslie was the basis for the TV show in the 70s, Frank's Place, which was probably to date one of the most honest depictions of black life in the South to show up on a television screen. But those names, you know, we know who Paul Prudhomme is. We know who Emeril Lagasse is. But we don't know the names of those cooks who are now septuagenarians, octogenarians, nonagenarians. And this generation is still passing before us. I think that if we don't pay attention to that generation, we lose this opportunity to bridge some kind of race and class gap that exists today in a time when today we realize the value of food. And let's recapture those stories of those cooks, that Willie Mae Seton, Austin Leslie, before that linkage is gone.
Mm-hmm. It seems like part of your mission is that recovery. Are you also saying that the danger is, when these people disappear, clearly something is lost as concerns tradition, but is something lost in as concerns food, as concerns recipes, as concerns a presentation or a style of cuisine?
Yeah, I think there is a loss of just, you know, technique, tradition, knowledge. But I think even more than the recipe lost, it's the life story lost. Mm-hmm. It is that possibility of kind of knitting the South back together by way of kind of common ground, a common humanity shared at the table, a common love and respect for a cultural creation that black and white both take pride in, and that being our food. I mean, if you think about the kind of cultural creations that have come out of the South, whether that be music, literature, I think, you know, the thing that that single cultural creation in which we can take most pride is indeed our food. It is less stratifying, less class restricted than any other aspect of our culture.
We have a caller on line one. Welcome.
I have a question about the use of pork in Southern cuisine. I know that's not necessarily part of the New Orleans tradition, but I'm thinking about, you said you were born in Georgia.
Yes, ma'am.
My family comes from North and South Carolina, so I know that, you know, throwing a piece of fat back or smoked ham hocks in greens or beans or whatever is a standard. If you don't have meat in it, it's not really cooked right, you know? But I wondered about whether given the attention that's focused on, you know, eating and good health today, if Southern cuisine has shifted, as far as you know, from putting, you know, pork in everything to maybe smoked turkey wings or some other type of smoked meats, just what's happening with Southern cuisine along the lines of health and high blood pressure and, sure, you know, all the things that, that people worry about today?
Well, it's a good question. It's one that, that I hear fairly often. One, I think you accurately described the use of pork in Southern cookery, and that's as flavoring.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about the ham hock. It's about the ham hock as flavoring for the greens.
Right.
And I think done well, that need not be such an unhealthy combination.
Mm-hmm.
The way I cook at home, now having said that, I'll tell you this. When I cook greens at home, I'm cooking with olive oil, garlic, and then I might chop up a piece of bacon in there.
Okay.
And I don't feel like I'm losing anything, and I'm not necessarily doing it for – I'm not thinking about my health when I step to the stove. I'm thinking about the fact that there's a can of olive oil to my right in the same way there was a can of bacon grease to my mother's right when she stepped to the stove.
Okay.
It's – you know, so I think that Southern food is evolving. I think there is – you know, in the last 20 years, there's been an explosion in kind of white tablecloth restaurants that take traditional Southern recipes, update them, taking into account not always health concerns, but just a respect for the ingredient
right,
and a respect for, you know, a concomitant respect for the traditions that undergird all this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is evolving. I think that, you know, an emphasis upon fresher ingredients and a lighter hand at cookery is more prevalent now than it was 10, 20 years ago.
Right. But isn't it true, though, that for a lot of large Southern families that didn't have a lot of money, eating those scraps of meat, you know, would be the only meat they had. So it really wasn't just for flavoring. It was also just to make a meal, make it stretch, you know.
Yeah, I mean, pork, you know, and again, we're talking about pork here. You know, the pig fattens more quickly than almost any animal.
Right.
You know, it takes a lot more grain to fatten up a cow than it does a pig.
Mm-hmm.
So the pig was always the frugal food of the South.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right in terms of offcuts, you know, whether it's hocks or maws or necks or tails or whatever the case might be, those were frugal foods. They were used to stretch, and they were used to flavor.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great passage in one of Zora Neale Hurston's books wherein she describes someone taking a hock, tying a string around it, dipping it into the pot of greens, and then after cooking it, pulling the hock out to save for another use. So,
okay.
I mean, yes, frugality drives so much of this cookery, and frugality meets kind of invention meets, you know, is how you end up with what we define as Southern cookery.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Well, with the proliferation of white tablecloth restaurants, how is Southern food evolving then? Or is it about loss? Is it a natural evolution that you would expect?
I think white tablecloth restaurants in a lot of ways are becoming almost museums of traditional Southern cookery.
Hmm.
You know, it's if you think about a chef like Frank Stitt of Highlands Bar and Grill in Birmingham, Alabama, that restaurant is now over 25 years old. Frank is a native of Cullman, Alabama, who kind of saw baby Jesus while in the South of France and said, you know, why haven't I been cooking this way all along? Why don't I have respect for my native ingredients? And then returned to Alabama, wherein he applied that. I think that kind of marriage of French technique and Southern ingredients, Italian technique and Southern ingredients, I think that has become the norm. But the good chefs may look to the French for technique, but they look to old receipt books, They look to their forebears, you know, for inspiration, for kind of traditional recipes. And the marriage of the two, you end up with something that's really compelling and is worthy of a white tablecloth, I think.
Mm-hmm. And here in this country, in what ways do you see Southern food spreading beyond the South?
Southern food has gone through a number of periods of being in vogue. You know, in the late 1960s, when soul food was in vogue, you know, that is the food of, you know, former Southerners, in many cases, black urban Southerners who have moved north. You know, and when that was in vogue in the 1960s, you know, that's the same time when soul music was in vogue. That's the same time wherein soul power and black power were emerging. And, you know, this is a time when Vogue magazine is writing about soul food as the hippest, newest thing. In the 1970s, you see Jimmy Carter you know, his rise to the presidency. You remember the campaign slogan was Grits and Fritz, you know, you know, Carter was a peanut farmer. Carter was, you know, a man of the people whose family farmed worms in Plains. In the 1980s, you see Southern food come in vogue again. Paul Prudhomme rises to the fore, and Cajun food, a subset of Southern food, arises. And then you see again, more recently, this kind of the Alice Waters phenomenon the emphasis upon fresh and local and sustainable cookery. The South has the potential to be in the lead there because the tethers that connect farm and table in the South are not as frayed in the American South as they are in perhaps other regions. So it's been in vogue a number of times and will continue, you know, cyclically to be in vogue.
We were talking yesterday about your trip up to Gary, and you were mentioning this Tennessee eatery that you had come across.
Yeah.
And when you engaged the owner, he revealed that he's not even from Tennessee. And so I'm curious also about that sort of connection. In what way are folks who really don't apparently have a connection to the South drawn to Southern cooking? What is it about Southern? Otherwise put, you know, TV shows, there are all these TV shows about cooking in general, are really those things are really in vogue. I'm curious about what it is about Southern cooking that is in vogue for folks who apparently have no connection.
I think for many people, it's the same instinct that draws them to blues music. It's the same instinct that draws them to folk art and outsider art. It's the same instinct that says there was a writer for the Atlantic Monthly in the 1890s who wrote of going south and of going south to commune with our contemporary ancestors. This idea that there's a past in the present in the South. And I think that's a lot of what people seek when they come south. Now, whether that's accurate or not, you know, you come south, you know, and I'll take you to a number of meat and three restaurants serving fried chicken and mashed potatoes, and everybody working in the place is Hispanic and recent immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what people seek, is they seek, you know, this contemporary ancestor. They seek in a nation that is rapidly homogenizing, they seek, you know, something different, something rooted in place, something rooted in a past. Now, whether that, again, is something, you know, if that is to be found in the South is a question, but I think that's what drives it.
You're listening to Focus 580, and our guest today is John T. Edge, a Southern food writer and a columnist for the New York Times. You mentioned a little bit earlier, you mentioned a little bit earlier, you talked about cooking, and I'm curious about the relationship between your love of the meal and your interest in how it's prepared. Are you as equally interested in preparing the meal and cooking and in that aspect of food?
I'm not as interested. No, I'm a better eater than I am a cook, and I'm a better writer about I think the steps that lead up to the kitchen and then steps that lead away from the kitchen. And I think some of that is because I'm chafing under in this role as a food writer, you know, and you and I have talked about this some that you know, as food writing is typically defined, I kind of reject most of that. I'm not interested in kind of gauzy, sentimental takes on grandma's fried chicken. And I think that my attempt to define my own writing as not that leads me away from recipe-driven stuff and leads me away from the kitchen and toward the dining room table and on the other end of the continuum toward the fields, toward the farm.
I'm interested. We were talking about writing, and so much of what you do is about more than merely, you know, grandma's fried chicken. I mean, you talk about the space. You talk about the personnel. You talk about the clientele. I'm curious what it is that you look for, or what it is that you look for that indicates you've got a potential story there.
Well, you mentioned my recent trip to Gary, Indiana, and I'll use that as an example. I went to Gary on just a couple of days ago because, you know, I know that as a place where to which many Southerners decamped during the Great Migration. I knew that as now, you know, a town of, you know, a black majority town. I knew that, well, I assumed that if I drove through Gary, I would find kind of outposts of the South. And probably the most interesting outpost of the South that I came upon in this trip was a place called Tennessee Country Meats, right on the main drag on the outskirts of Gary. And, you know, if I'm reading a place like a text, you know, if I'm in Gary, Indiana, and I see a sign that says Tennessee Country Meats, I'm pulling over. but, you know, and in going in that place, you know, I walked in the front door. And right in front of me was a refrigerator case, a freezer case, and there were five varieties of biscuits in the freezer case. And on top of the freezer case, there must have been 12 different varieties from Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi of cane syrup. In the back of the store, I saw salted ribs, like pork ribs. I'd never seen that in my life. I saw, you know, aged fatback, which is the term they had for aged fatback, and then regular fatback. And then in the refrigerator case, alongside, I saw Mississippi brand sausage and Magnolia brand souse. And, you know, these products that were in essence, incorporating the tropes of the South, the tropes of my home place of Mississippi, where I now live. And I knew in that there's a story because there's an ability to read that place. What is that place trying to tell me? It's trying to tell me that this is a clubhouse for expatriate Southerners. It's trying to tell me that, you know, that those products, Mississippi sausage, that I've never seen in Mississippi, as if it was made purely for the export market, the export market being from Mississippi to Gary, Indiana. You know, that's a story, and I just need to be quiet. I need to look. I need to listen and read that store like a text.
How often are people willing to work with you, or is there a sort of – a lot of the stories you write are about people, too.
Right.
And it seems like a lot of people – They also tend to not necessarily be forthcoming with their recipes or with their secrets or whatever. To what degree are people just jumping in and saying, oh, please write about me, I'm going to tell you everything, or is there a certain bridge you have to gap?
Well, there's an interesting tension there, I think, in that, you know, if I was writing about white tablecloth restaurants there and I called up and said, you know, I'm interested in writing about you. There, you know, someone would stick a PR agent on me, and you know, the doors would open, and access would be granted, and you know, it would all be easy, and the answers would be well packaged, and I'd be bored. You know, access to the sort of folks that I like to write about is not as easy, and there's a level of you know, there's a level of mistrust. A guy with a notebook looks like he's from the health department a lot of times. you know, and there's not a sense of, or I'm a restaurant critic, or I'm there to take grandma's recipe, and I'm there to do none of those things. But if I can engage somebody in conversation and just help them realize that I just want them to, you know, tell me about their life and their life in that place, I can get somewhere.
Without naming names, or you can name names if you want, what person has been least forthcoming or what establishment?
I think probably the least forthcoming person you mentioned earlier in this interview, this Jones Barbecue Diner in Marianna, Arkansas, in the Arkansas Delta. Mr. Jones, the proprietor, it's about a two-hour drive from my house, and it's stunningly great barbecue. Now, I don't want to become such a poser that I won't say that. I mean, part of the reason I love writing about food is I love food. But Mr. Jones, I made that trip from my home to Jones Barbecue Diner in Marion, Arkansas, 5 times over the course of about 4 weeks. I sent him letters. I FedExed things to him. You know, here's something I've written before. And ultimately on the fifth trip, you know, he opened up and talked to me for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. That was it. And I don't blame him. I mean, you know, what's he got to gain from talking to me? You know, he's concerned with the business in Marianna, Arkansas. He's not concerned with, you know, some barbecue pilgrim from New York City who's going to read the piece and come flying down to Marianna. He's concerned with his day-to-day customers. And I respect that. Mm-hmm. I wish he'd opened up a little bit more to me. But in the end, even fact-checking the piece, when the fact-checker for the Oxford American tried to confirm details, he refused. He just said he got the story.
You're listening to Focus 580. The number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. And toll-free, if you're outside of Champaign-Urbana, 800-222-9455. John T., in one of your essays, you talk about, well, you pledge your troth to the place of the restaurant in the American experience. And so I wonder if you talk about that a little bit, how you see the role of the restaurant in the American experience.
Well, I think about the restaurant for much of our history as a democratic space, because I'm interested in this kind of the restaurant on the lower economic end of the spectrum. I think about a restaurant as, you know, a space where people, you know, and even in the segregated South, black and white commune. I think of a restaurant as, you know, I think of like the typical lunch counter, where conceptually and not always realistically, you know, everyone in essence stoops down to sit at the same level. Mm. I think of that as the American restaurant. I don't think, you know, I think the white tablecloth as an American ideal is fairly recent. I think of that lunch counter, the kind of long, unbroken space wherein everyone kneels, everyone is on the same level. I think of that as the ideal that I celebrate, that I'm most interested in. And I think it's you know, quite interesting that during the Civil Rights Movement, that was one of the most contested spaces, was that democratic, long expanse of counter.
Why? What is it about? That's too vague a question. I'm curious about, because as soon as you mentioned the Civil Rights Movement, I'm thinking of, you know, the meetings of CORE that happened in Chicago that are happening around a diner. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King in you know, SCLC in Atlanta.
Right. Pascal's.
Exactly. Happenstance? What is it about the food space that draws us to it?
Well, you know, I mean, on a very core level, the most intimate act in which we engage on a regular basis, right, is to eat. You know, I mean, there is something to be said in that idea of breaking bread. And I think, You know, there's a humanity in that experience that shows our better selves, our worst selves. We're you know, that intimacy bred at the table, you know, speaks volumes about those who gather. I mean, I think about, I wrote about this woman named Georgia Gilmore, who was a cook during the Civil Rights Movement, and she ran, in essence, a house restaurant in Montgomery, Alabama. And, you know, she brought together, you know, King and Kennedy and LBJ, John Lewis, all those people, you know, came to the back door of her house to break bread. And the symbolic nature of that, of being elbow to elbow at a small table, you know, on a back street in Montgomery, mattered as much as the speech given that night.
Mm. We have a caller on line one. Welcome.
Thank you. It's fascinating that you're talking about this. This is these are the tastes of my childhood. I grew up in Illinois, but my family's from Alabama. My grandparents ran a barbecue restaurant in Hueytown, Alabama in the 60s and 70s. And they'd get up at 2 in the morning, and my grandmother would make 30 pies from scratch, and my grandfather would throw pork shoulders into the charcoal pit. And it's wonderful, wonderful food. But what you were talking about with the lunch counter fascinated me, too, because my grandfather was by no means what we would call a modern-day liberal, but he was fundamentally egalitarian. And when he first opened up, he had to train his black customers not to come to the back door. He would just say, no, you're just as good as anybody else. Come to the front door, which caused some interesting discussions with his white customers. But he ran his business the way he thought it ought to be run, and he was very much about that egalitarian eating.
Well, I think you're right in that, you know, sociologists tell us that food patterns, food habits are among our most conservative. And I'm not speaking of political ideology, but, you know, those most immutable habits. And you know, that seating pattern, that kind of dance, fitful dance of service in a restaurant was fairly difficult to break. I think about, there's a barbecue restaurant I went to in not long ago, just outside of Austin, you could still see the two bars. The bars were set back to back, so that and there used to be a wall between the two bars. The wall is gone now, but there's still two bars. There were still two service windows. There were still two jukeboxes with different music on each jukebox. And though the wall is gone, the seating patterns remained pretty much the same.
That's fascinating. By the way, on a different topic, have you been to Sweetie Pie's soul food restaurant in St. Louis?
No, but I've heard about this. This is a woman who was she a singer?
That's exactly right. And I've eaten there once, and I was dreaming about the macaroni and cheese for 3 days after.
I'm dreaming about it now.
It really is that good.
I wanted to ask the caller, in y'all's move from Alabama to Illinois, did y'all retain the same patterns of eating, or was it diluted in some way?
Well, my father went from, he was born literally in a sharecropper shack, because my grandfather at that time was a sharecropper, and wound up getting a scholarship to Harvard, went to Harvard Business School, and moved to Chicago with my mother, whom he had met at Harvard. My mother was from the Chicago area. And that disconnect between my mother's family and my father's family was really quite something to behold. But one thing we all agreed on was that the Southern cooking was better. The food was just better. I mean, we went when my great uncle retired as a Baptist missionary. We had a big family reunion, and we had a state park down in Alabama, and everybody brought food. And I think we had 12 different kinds of fried chicken, 30 different pot. It was unbelievable. Now, none of this was healthy, but who cares?
Thank you.
It was food.
I want to thank the caller for that call, and just mention, John T. has written a series of books, four books on iconic American foods, one of which is fried chicken, and there are a number of, on the one hand, great stories of these different traditions of fried chicken from across the country, and also the recipes. With a group of friends, we, about once or twice a month, we get together and have fried chicken Sundays where we try a different recipe, and I'd encourage you all to go to John T.'s book and check some of those out. Also, you can check out John T.'s website, www.johntedge.com, and get a sense of his work and what he's thinking about and doing. This is maybe a little bit of an unfair question, but what's your all-time favorite recipe to cook on the one hand and then also to eat?
Wow. I think the thing I cook most often is collard greens. You know, I wrote my thesis on pot liquor, so it seems somehow linked. You know, where I live in Mississippi, we can get access to great greens 12 months out of the year. And it doesn't matter if mustards are coming in or turnips are coming in or collards are coming in or dandelion greens, whatever it is. I like that kind of sharp bite of fresh greens. I like cooking them. I like seeing, you know, this massive bunch of greens kind of distilled down, cooked down into this kind of broth of pot liquor, this kind of heap of tobacco-y kind of, you know, greens. That's my favorite thing to cook and my favorite thing to eat. And if I have my druthers, I'm making cornbread, flat top, fried cornbread, and dunking cornbread into pot liquor, and sopping the two. And I know that sounds like corn pone and country, but it's honest. I mean, you know, it's something that there's an innate kind of taste for this that cannot be satisfied by a burger and cannot be satisfied by, you know, French fries, a burrito. I crave that kind of taste of place and taste of home, and I get it out of a bowl of greens.
Has the sort of two-pronged question, has the proliferation really of fast food and things like that, is that in some way damaging the foods that we're talking about? But conversely, is also the sort of proliferation of white tablecloth restaurants like we were talking about, is that in some way, are those establishments moving away from the collard greens, the food that is not more traditionally upper class on some level?
I think what's happening is in that middle ground between fast food restaurants, you know, and a white tablecloth restaurant. I think that's where the real possibility is in, you know, that middle class and working middle class restaurant. When that restaurant starts to serve, and I think more and more are, local produce as opposed to canned produce, when that kind of everyday $10 meal draws locally instead of off the Sysco truck, that's the real hope for me. And I, you know, I can't speak to the trends of, you know, certainly fast food continues to make inroads, but I see real hope in that kind of middle ground. I went to, you know, when I was in Gary a couple of days ago, I went to a place called Jimmy's Coney Island, which was, you know, a Coney Island restaurant serving, you know, hot dogs, chili dogs, and the like. And I asked the guy, you know, because what they advertised once you got inside was fried chicken and collard greens and the like. And he said, you know, 10 years ago we used to serve Coney's. Now we serve collard greens. The guy was from Mississippi. We had a great conversation, and I ate a beautiful bowl of greens that were grown down the road by a friend of his. That's hopeful to me.
That is hopeful. That's great. It's 10:50. We have about 7 minutes left. You're listening to Focus 580. Our guest today is John T. Edge. writer of food, of Southern foods, of Southern cultures. If you have questions or want to talk to John T. Edge, call us at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or toll-free at 800-222-9455. When we talk about Southern food, like the earlier caller talked about, we tend to think, you know, pig, pork. We think in broad brushstrokes, but every region has its own particularity. And so I'm curious if you'd talk a little bit about the range of what we're talking about when we're talking about Southern food.
I mean, if you think about the American South, it is in geography, in total geography, comparable to Western Europe. I mean, this is a large and quite diverse region. And if you want to look for commonalities, you come back to pork and corn as being kind of the bedrock of Southern food, and you come back to West African and Western European as being the kind of cultural bedrocks. And yet, if you're in, if you're in the low country of South Carolina, eating basically an okra gumbo, you're going to find, at the other end of the South in Arkansas, in the right around Little Rock, you're going to find, no knowledge, no expertise with an okra gumbo. You're going to find someone there who would wax poetic about the buffalo fish that they score and cut into kind of arcs of bone and flesh and deep fry. They may know gumbo as a Cajun food. They may know gumbo as something that Popeyes serves, but it's not everyday food. And that range is so broad, both in terms of ingredients, experience, race. You're going to find pockets of Italian communities in, not far from that little buffalo fish joint I mentioned, which is in Little Rock. In Tiny Town, in the northwestern corner of Arkansas, you're going to find Italian enclaves where the food of the place, the food of the moment, is fried chicken and spaghetti. There's this great range.
A little bit earlier, you had talked about what you're doing with your writing as a sort of personal reckoning on some level. An essay you wrote for which you won an award, and a wonderful essay about your return to Athens, Georgia, and to the open house. I wonder if you would speak about that a little bit.
Sure. This is a restaurant no longer existing in Athens, Georgia, called Blanche's Open House. And as a student at the University of Georgia in the 1980s, that's where I would go late at night when I had a snootful. I mean, that's where we would go to sober up. That's where we'd go to, to kind of grease up. And I knew when I arrived in college that I shouldn't be going there. My father had told me, of the history of that place. And yet I kind of sloughed it off. And then years later, in writing this essay, I went back to try to figure out that place and realized that this restaurant where I had spent my drunken nights in college was, in fact, a kind of a clubhouse for the Klan in the 1960s. One of the kind of signal moments of the civil rights movement, the murder of Lemuel Penn on a bridge just outside of Athens, had been hatched and celebrated in that restaurant. So I'd spent a lot of my career kind of thinking about how restaurants are incubators of good, how restaurants are incubators of community, how restaurants serve this function, this idea we talked about earlier, this long unbroken counter. But what if a bunch of SOBs gather at that counter? What if instead of, community-minded, civic-minded good folk, what if evil folk gather in a restaurant? What kind of community does that incubate? You get your answer when you delve into the history of a restaurant like Blanche's Open House.
Hmm. And you actually returned and some years later and met with Blanche and her former Klansman husband, or maybe still Klansman husband.
Yeah, I think if anything, in the wake, Blanche was the more intransigent than her husband. He was remorseful about his role in this murder. But, you know, in confronting, fitfully confronting Blanche and confronting my own history, you know, I didn't pull it off so well. I wrote it fairly well, I think. But, you know, I was trying to make sense of my own kind of this idea we've talked about before, this kind of debt of pleasure. You know, who's serving my food? What do I know about them? What story do they have to tell me? And in this case, it was kind of a story of my own misspent youth.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful essay, and it's a lot more than that. I'd encourage our listeners to go to John T.'s website, www.johntedge.com, and you can read Open House and some of his other work. Also, John T. will be reading this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore at 4:30, talking about some of the subject matter we've been talking about today. It's free and open to the public. I'd encourage you all to come to that. So here in Illinois, we have about less than a minute. Here in Illinois, you've been introduced to at the University of Illinois to Champaign-Urbana food. What's your take?
I haven't had enough to speak well or ill. I'm sure I will speak well at the end of my time. I had great pizza last night, and this morning I went to a diner across from my hotel and had sausage and hash browns and eggs, and I was sitting at that long unbroken counter and I started talking to folks. And that's kind of what I want out of a travel experience. I mean, I think one of the things I really value about a restaurant is it gives you access to a community. It gives you a reason to talk to a stranger. And at that counter, that's kind of where I belong.
Well, that's all we have time for. Thank you, John T., for joining me. I want to thank my guest. And I encourage you all to stick around. There's more Focus 580 coming up after the market updates and news from NPR.
Support for Focus 580 comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace. Let's go right out to the pits in Kansas City. December wheat now at 477 and three quarters, down 4.5. March 493 and three quarters, down 4.5. December wheat at CME Group, 465.5, down 5. March 485, down 5.25. May 497.5, down 5.25. December corn 340, down 6.5. March 353.5, down 6.25. May 362.25, down 6.75. July 370.25, down 7.25. October crude oil 71.47 is up 54 cents. November beans 946.5, down 13.5. January 950, down 14. March 952.25, down 15.25. May at 952, down 15. July 955, down 14.5. October soybean meal 295.80, down 5.30. October soybean oil